Welcome to The Smiling Fox, a Mythic Bastionland podcast. My name is Horst.
I'm Brian.
And hey, I'm William.
And for today's show, we have an acclaimed comic writer for Image and Marvel, an award-winning game designer for the role-playing game Die, a role-playing game, and a former video game journalist for arguably the most relevant video game magazine of all times, the Amiga Power. Welcome, Kieran Gillen.
Delighted to be here, and always glad to hear Amiga Power shouted out.
So you have been writing for the coolest magazine of all time under the pseudonym Sea Monster, but I think you were mainly responsible for like shareware stuff. Is that true?
And tips. I was basically the I was a huge Amiga Power fan. There's no way of putting it. Like I always describe what I did on the Amiga Power as like playing Triangle in the Beatles, you know, which is I was only playing Triangle in the Beatles, but I was in the Beatles. I was a complete and utter fan, and I did like a handful of reviews because I did my degree in Bath, which is where Future Publishing was set. So Paul Mellerick, a DJ and writer, came up to me in the club one day and said, "Hey, do you want to write for Amiga Power?" Because I was somebody who wrote for Amiga Power's letters page a lot, so they could tell I could throw words together, and they gave me a break, and I basically paid my way through like my second year at university writing for them until they closed because the world is unfair.
Yeah, the world is stupid because they support stuff that shouldn't be supported and take away the money where it should land. What is your favorite Amiga game and why is it Moonstone?
It's not Moonstone. It's funny because people are all pausing here because I'm usually going to Speedball 2. And I'm not sure I believe that, but it's, you know, Speedball 2, Brutal Deluxe. Brutal Deluxe is arguably one of the best video game names of all time. It sounds interesting. It's like a weird murderous supermodel. And that's really an interesting period. Sensible World of Soccer, like I was really into SWAS. I mean, who wasn't? I mean, stuff like Rainbow Islands.
World of Sensible Soccer is the real answer, though.
Was Speedball, am I remembering this correctly? Like, obviously it was a future sports game, but was it like so zoomed in you couldn't see the entire pitch?
The prequel was slightly further out, but the first one was much tighter, like even tighter than something like Kickoff 2. And it was all about brutality and close tackles, and I never had a problem with actually it being so close as opposed to Kickoff, where I did. But Streetball, it was half fighting game, half sliding game simulator. The one I always remember is one of my friends Maz, who is now a miniature painter, was the best speedball player in the entire world we knew. And he just beat us all. And it's all one house party where we got him very drunk, insisted on him playing us all, beat him because he was that drunk, and then we never played it ever again. That's being a teenager in the Midlands.
Amazing. All right, but we are obviously not here to talk about the Amiga, although I would love to. We are here to talk about your Mythic Bastionland campaign. And I'm interested to hear, how did you do the setup? Was it by the book? Just the realm creation? Was it relationships or was it something extra?
I was really quite by the book. Like, in terms of I generate the realm at quite the high level. You know, I did the ruler, you know, and then I did the four areas and play, you know, all that. I generated relationships between them. I played, and that's the core thing I did. I placed myths, and just by the way the sparks hit me, I had it end up having a reason for the knights to come. Because I rolled the ruler was the Fox Knight. It was. The Fox Knight, and I rolled something like a migration injury as his background. And between that and a couple of other sparks, I got the idea of, oh no, he moved here because they're reclaiming land due to an invading force. He got injured, except of course, due to the Fox Knight's powers, he's been faking being injured for like 15 years. So it's me doing the Fisher King, a fake Fisher King story. And also ripped off the plot of a Stephen Donaldson book called Warden's Need. It's like basically he's faking it entirely to lure the enemies to him. And due to the relationships of the other people I rolled, they're like two of the men up being children of him, both enormously pissed off with him. Because he's entirely relying on everyone else to do the job of keeping the kingdom running to lure them in because he believes he can spring the trap. And of course it's led to the alienation of his daughter, alienation of his son, and also the fourth person was like an alchemist person who was involved in coming to the reason for a reason. And he's, I think the prompt for the city was a soft citadel or something like that. And I took that to be, oh no, that's where they can invade from. And he's actually a traitor. So this created a basic political situation, all from the prompts. And then I've got all that in my head, and then I bring the players to it. And the actual, the reason why, the background was the one sentence, the son who is in charge of the sharp sit, the sharp castle or something like that, he's put a call for help. This realm is in trouble, there's been invasions, we need knights. So they arrive with word that the ruler has summoned them, and that's just untrue. The person who summoned them is their son. And we went from there. You know, and the knight said, you know, we just rolled the right plane, there was no like discussion of background. The entire prompt was, you've come to this kingdom because you've been called for it, and you are knights who have forsworn the oaths. And we went from there. And that was just the, and I mean, knowing that background is the reason why everything else played across the background, across the entire campaign, at least so far anyway.
I love the fact that you rolled background for the ruler. Did you, as Amanda P, did you go through the whole list of prompts for your main NPCs?
No, is the best way. I turn to the spark table when I need one. If I don't know something, I'll turn to the prompt table. If I'm not sure of anything, I'll roll the dice. And the second I do that, that becomes sacred. So it's like, I don't roll a prompt unless I'm going to 100% use it. You know, that's the contract I make, as I like to call them, the seers. I must honour the seers, which of course the dice and the sparks tables. And you know, if I consult them, I'm going to, whatever that is now true. Because one of the really telling things about my campaign is the fortune rolls have been incredibly bad for every single NPC. Like, I've rolled a one like almost every single time. And that's like, so I've gone, if I'm rolling the dice, see if this person survives, they're going to die now. If they roll a one. Oh no, I rolled a one. There's that part of the game. So I'm being just a very story forward, political. Story forward's the wrong word, because that implies I have a story to tell. I haven't, I've got a setting. You know, these are people, and if you're going to do a big Arthurian War of the Roses type setup, which is kind of how mine became, you need about the people. What do these people want? Why are they upset? What are their passions? You know, why are they doing all the stuff they're doing? And then everything else plays out inside that. And the players get to interact with the politics, because there is real politics. My campaign at its best is when you've got this genuinely, all the people are trying to do War of the Roses, and all of a sudden, I don't know, the Hydra eats an army. You know, we've got something that's really quite a serious political game, and then suddenly the myths throw it all out. And suddenly you're dealing with the fact that you're trying to lead an invasion, and the entire realm is full of fog, and no one can see anything, and then winter suddenly arrived because the wheels turned again. That's the game.
There was recently someone on the Discord server who suggested pausing all other myths because the company was busy solving one of the myths. And then someone said, no, you got to let that roll on, because then you're going to have interactions. It makes it more complicated and more interesting.
The last game I had was, they finally ended the wheel. After literally like 30 years of play or whatever, because I've done multiple age skips. They finally aged this major problem that's ruined them at every stage, and they've had one last leap, and of course they've missed summer. So there's a famine in the kingdom. So they're trying to deal with the famine. And the next myth I've rolled, of course, is the troll. The regenerating meaty troll. And they go to one of the arsehole seers, who gives them the kind of, oh yeah, I know there's a source of meat in the kingdom. And now the players have to work out whether they're going to what they're going to do with this troll. And the best fortune, this is probably at least the funniest fortune roll in the entire game, was they find the arm, they don't know it's a troll yet. And they figure, well, okay, we'll cook this enormous arm, let's see what it tastes of. Let's make our squire eat it. We suddenly go less mythic, more OSR, I must admit, at this point. And they, you know, they're cooking this kebab meat, roll it, and it's a six. This is the best meat anyone's ever tasted. Go. Now it's a delicious troll. Now they end up, you know, they don't end up eating the troll, because they decide, no, you know, he's got furniture. we're not going to like use, like, you know, the troll as an infinite kebab. But the idea was there for a second. And that's myths interacting. That's like, you know, you forward, just cascade. And if you actually got a more realistic is the wrong word I mean, reactive world for me. If you've got a very reactive world of people doing stuff, the myths have even more stuff to interact with.
Is that a way you would run other games as well? Are you familiar with the blob principle?
I am.
And blobiness is more associated with the OSR and maybe Dread games, whereas most story gamers would probably scoff at the idea that you cannot change everything if, you know, something cool or more interesting comes up in play. Do you adjust your playstyle to Mythic Pestilent?
I'm very compliant to a game. Like, I like to try to meet a game where it is, because I try to think, okay, what's this game want to do? I'm going to try to do that, even if it's against my normal playstyle. Like, I'm very, you know, I'm quite character forward as a GM. You know, I like people and having people interact. And even before I was involved with Theory, my natural way of running, even a trad game, had devolved to prep a situation, run from there. Like, have these characters who are agents in the world, and they have the wants and desires, and as people interact, make a logical, reasonable decision what they would do given their knowledge, and go from there, and have it cascading. With Mythic Bastion Land, the fact it's wired the way it is makes me want to honour that. So, like, yeah, I'm very aware that I'm doing a kind of narrative first blob principle. You know, I'm like, the king feels this. The king, like, one of the bigger beats is that the king ends up riding off to the east to try to defeat the people who are invading forever. And that's the idea. And that's a complete story game beat. The king goes off into the east and he passes the kingdom on and yada, yada, yada. But it's not. It's just what he wants to do. Like, if he got killed, that wouldn't happen. If, you know, if the invaders won, that wouldn't happen. It's just something he wants to do. And now it's like, it's one of these kind of things. Where does story begin? And when does... Because the Western definition of story is like, you know, desires. What will you do to get what you want? That's kind of how you define drama. And that really does fit well with blobiness. You know, because story is a device to allow us to discover what characters actually are. And you do that by in extremis. You put them in a situation, what you really want. You know, you say you want this, but what do you actually want? And that's kind of how I think about all these people. So yeah, I view it, at least in this game, I very much try to honour that, partially because, as you say, it's slightly against what I would do in some other games. I would, cheat is the wrong word, but I would accept it in a different game, I wouldn't. In this, no, I really want to try to run it as, let's run a simulationist. Let's run this weird simulation of like 70 years of these people's lives and see what happens.
When you get to a decision point, an NPC needs to make a choice about do they leave the realm or stay or whatever. Are you always considering what they would want to do and going with that choice, or are you having any randomness there?
I think the second I've set their desires, I've decided who they are, little. Like, in that kind of, that king, he has, you know, he's a guy with a 30-year plan. You know, he ended up, like, pretending to be sick for 30 years. That implies a certain strength of will. Now, it's entirely possible the players could have talked him out of it, or said something else. Of course, by that point, they'd met the children who'd been essentially treated incredibly badly and thrown on the sacrifice of, you know, like, no, they wanted that king gone, because it was the... Also, they really liked the woman who was going to become queen, the Meteor Knight, who was, like, agreeably feisty. So all that cascades onwards, but, like, what I do is I randomise the initial desires. Like, one of the best things about the age skips I've been doing is the generating children. You know, like, what are the succession lines? So, like, the queen's son is a complete arsehole who hates the knights. And I did that with, like, his motivation was envious something like that. So, he is clearly fully overshadowed by the knights. And this other one who's like the son of someone else who isn't in line of the throne, he hero worships the knights. So instantly you get these kind of different responses. And the one on the right, the far eastern flank, taking over from the guy who called them to the kingdom, wants to build a reputation. He's like quite braggarty, but he's quite more useful. And then they hit, like, they've all matured to another age. And suddenly there's one problem. Like, you know, everyone of course hates the actual person who's the succession, but he's like by far the best knight the kingdom has ever seen. He's rolled like 18, 14 stats. He clearly should be in charge of something. He's really very good at what he does. He's not in charge of anything else. The king, you know, the place that's most under threat is the person who desperately wants to earn his battle. He's got crap stats. He's bad at his job. So, like, the kingdom might end up being in real military trouble because they've got the wrong person in charge of this eastern flank. But, like, are they going to do anything about it? Especially when this guy is so awful and hates them. And they're all going to be dead shortly because they've got vitality too. You know what I mean? Like,
it's almost as if feudal system don't produce always the best leaders.
Yes. It's quite exciting. I mean, in this weird case, it's like this guy is the best leader, abstractly, but he just hates the players. So, I mean, especially as the characters have got older, and especially because they've just solved the world of time, which is a wonderful metaphor for like what's going on in the game. As they approach old age, they've defeated the wheel of time and the wheel is continuing to turn. They will be left behind. If you get my story game ahead on, that's really poetic. Mm. And now they have to think about who is going to follow them. Who is, you know, what is going to be left behind when they're dead? Especially like one of them has kids, you know, and all these kind of different things. Like the player who, we've had this bit, a player's retired their character, a younger knight. They're now playing a younger knight. So it's two very old knights, as in hit old, then gone age further, and the one young knight. So you've got a very different power dynamic in terms of like one person who's very fresh and the other person who's got material power in the world. They can order stuff and people will happen, but basically can't run anymore. You know, the other one is like clarity too. They have no idea what's going on. And as I said, one of them's retired and she is in charge of the kingdom, which of the traitorous alchemist of the Northwest, but she hasn't got an heir. So if we carry on another age and she dies, it's kind of up to the queen who takes over that realm, or is it? Does the queen, does that, you know, yada yada. So all that stuff is interesting, and it's all opportunity for Sparks. Now, so yeah, it's a game, I'm trying to run the game through Sparks and character rather than plotting, because that's the difference between narrative and story. Story, you know, narrative is a series of events that happen. Story is kind of what we describe in retrospect.
I love that definition. And I think most OSR gamer would look at story as something that they talk about after it has finished, something that emerged. Mm. One question I have is, do you see some kind of tension between the linearity of the omens on the one hand and the kind of chaotic entropy of emergent story through, for example, story prompts?
Yeah, but that's kind of like, this is one of the reasons why it's not a story, I guess. I mean, the closest I get to be able to direct the story is when I choose where I choose to place the myth. Now, like, if I was being, I think if I was being even more random, I would choose where to place the myth, then randomly roll. And I do it the other way around. I'm placing myths afterwards, after I've rolled. And that's partially because I'm excited to roll a new myth. You know, it's not like planned. It's like, kind of, I want to see what happens next.
You've never, like, selected myths. You've always rolled
them. Every single one's random, which is kind of...
the way it should be.
I mean, it excites me because I'm like, I don't have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, the whole thing about the famine and then the troll turning up, that genuinely looks as planned an adventure as you could have written. You know, like if I sat down and wrote an adventure of what adventure, I could have, you know, I could have written that. Like, but it just turns up. And it's like, there's so much interesting stuff when I just submit story, no, that's the wrong word again, incident to the dice and just go with it. I mean, I said that. I think the height of the game, I mentioned this earlier, was the Fox Knight's entire like 30-year campaign is he's going to trick the army to invade. The army's going to march all the way to the kingdom. You're going to go all the way around the flank, take the castle and cut them off. We'll starve them to death and we'll crush them in a big battle. Like that's the, you know, it's a classic military tactic. And they're they're starting this walk and they're walking past the mist. So like halfway through the march, they can't see anything. So they're all blind army walking around trying to... Oh, then there's the wheel kicks in and now suddenly it's winter. So they've got entire army in winter and they're within vague marching distance of the castle. They've got the castle takeover. What on earth are you going to do now, guys? You know what I mean? Like, that's the myths distorting in the best possible way. The only thing that's... You know, I said the army... Would an army get eaten by a Hydra? Didn't happen this campaign, but could very easily have. You know? I view the world... Protecting the reality of the world is kind of the primary job. That the core of the game is those like 15, 16 pages of rules. And then you've got these 70 pages of distortions to the reality. So creating a realm with a real coherence and then these things arriving kick the world around and everyone has to suddenly deal with the fact that it's been misty for 20 years or whatever. That's the game. You know? And that's where it's delightful. The idea of myths as things have to be sought, things outside the norm, and when they arrive, changing everything. You know what I mean? And then you have to deal with it, which is funny.
One question I have is about this alchemist. Where did he come from? That there must be a spark table or a roll, right?
That was a roll. I rolled sort of like, it's one of the sparks. As in, I flipped up the, I think it's aggressive alchemist or something like that. Or like traitorous alchemist. And that was it. You know, so like, okay, he's that. Then it became like, what's he researching? This is the kind of the microscope principle in terms of ghost story game. Mm-hmm. So I've only got these. So at the beginning, I didn't really know what the ruler's deals were. I knew a little bit more about the Fox Knight, but I knew the like the daughter who became queen. Her prompt, I think, was forbidden love, and I kind of knew vaguely she was told she couldn't marry someone. That's what I knew. But the details of that emerged as I got closer to it and as I knew more about the world and I could plug stuff in. The in the case of the alchemist. He was near, like, when the Hydra emerged, he was quite near with the Hydras and stuff like that. So kind of like that classic Game of Thrones, I'm researching monster stuff, kicked in. And the myths tied together. This is tricky, because what is a spark? I think that's an interesting question. Like, when the Hydra, which was around 40, like, 50 years, across, like, two whole ages. You know, the Hydra has to be endured, and what's the line? The specifically, the embodiment of all sins, or something about it, something like that. And I... took that as a prompt. Oh, the reason why the Hydra is attacking the land is because of the awful lie of the Fox Knight to his children. Specifically, that's what the myth is. It's about this is the Hydra, and it essentially had to forgive it to death in the end. They ended up like, okay, we're going to take the queen, we're going to take her son, and they're going to roll out, and we're going to try to forgive the creature to death. And we went from there. So that's kind of like me just using that sentence, the embodiment of the embodiment of all sins, or the embodiment of worst sin. Mm-hmm.
But as a spark, as a prompt, we talked a little bit about blob, which is the idea that whatever is in your prep is now law, mm-hmm. and you have to obey that. And in my case, and it seems like in your case, that prep is extremely minimal. It is the spark table that you roll, and then obviously the way you interpret, and that will be different from one a referee to the other.
The kind of the blobiness, I want to suddenly, one thing struck me there, I just want to say quickly, is the, you may mention that whole thing about the Hydra. The second I decided that was true, it was true. It's not like I played with the idea of, oh no, it's the embodiment of the sins of the Father. The second I decided that, that was as true as anything else. And that's, you know what I mean? Like the sparks come up from all places, I guess.
But the motivation of the Hydra is initially hidden information. So how are you communicating that? Or is it, what, that was communicated somehow to the players?
Eventually it was seeking the seers. It's the classic, okay. Go to the seers, have them be awful, and eventually get them to do something for you.
And has that been at the forefront of your game? Are they using the seers
a lot? No, they're really not. It's one of the, they managed to like go, I think they went to like old age before they even met a seer face to face. Because the only seer they engaged with was the entombed seer. They eventually met them. So a lot of the time they'd just be ambling through and going for the myths as best they can. But specifically with the Hydra, they didn't want it. They really didn't want to just endure it. Because they were told very long it must be endured. They got that from the first seer. And the idea that we just have to ignore this Hydra while it's eating people was, you know, not something they were want. So they wanted to find mm-hmm. something else. And by that point, I'd started to think about the aforementioned sins of the place.
I read your blog post that was kind of the skim through the book that you did, where before you played it, you kind of flicked through Mythic Bastion and had your impressions of it. What was surprising when you got it to the table? Was there much that revealed itself to be different than what you expected?
That's a really good question, and my brain's immediately fried.
One thing that jumps out to me when I was reading through that is recurring mentions of Pendragon, and I'm wondering, is it Pendragon-y? I've never played Pendragon, so...
I've never played Pendragon. Pendragon's the one I've always wanted to play. And the idea of me going, oh, it's micro mm-hmm. Pendragon. And that becomes an intent. This is one of the things that... it's our campaign is... Well, it's not very Pendragon-y. It's not like ridiculously researched history of Arthuriana. But it's a generational saga of telling the story of a kingdom and the knight's attempt to, you know, engage with myth. We entered the game with that intent for all of us. Therefore, the game became that. When I first met Chris... like I just ranted how much I love the aging rules in Mythic Bastion Land, which is the least cool thing I think I've ever done. And I've done some pretty uncool things. And the second I saw that, I latched onto that as what was different to most games. As in putting aging and passage of time so core to the game, made me think that it was core to the game, which made when we pitched the game to each other in terms of running it, it was core to the game. We're going to play through the life and possibly more of these knights. We're going to, every 3 sessions or so, we're going to age drop.
Oh, that is the reason why you had these 3 age skips. It was decided beforehand, we want to explore this.
Yeah. My 3 people in my home game are all designers as well. So like they're kind of expressly interested in really going for it and what's different about this game. So we kind of decided early on we wanted to go through a lifespan of people. And how we ended up, like some of the ages were longer because it didn't feel the right place to age. But quite regularly, like, if you hit a major myth that's been a problem for a while and solve that, it suddenly feels, oh, this is the end of the age. And that's suddenly like, and that makes the myth feel bigger. Like this was the age when we, you know, the mist was finally disappeared after being here for 15 years. This was the age when the Hydra was finally defeated. This was, you know, and so on and so forth. Like, and that, especially if it's been really annoying. that feels like, and then there was 15 years of peace-ish. And then, I don't know, a troll appears. Us coming in was always the buy-in, so that makes it feel more Pendragon-y, so it becomes more about the kingdom, even though like only in these latest ages have we really kind of ran it, you know, the last 2 ages they've sort of ran a keep, you know, they've been previously knights, you know, as in knights and doing questy stuff, and only later on they've got to deal with the fact that, you know, oh no, there's a famine, it's your problem, or your wife doesn't want you to go out adventuring anymore because, you know, they don't want to orphan their son to you. You know, you've got Vitality 2, man. Just stay home. You know?
How did you do the age skip? Did you, for example, which is what I did, look at the political situation, kind of open question that was an advice I got from Brian, and then like try to project it into the future? Or was it as frozen in time as the myths?
I tried to extrapolate, you know what I mean? That's the best part. I mean, it's been, the first age jump was relatively small changes because they had only explored like, they basically only explored the southeast by at the first age skip. They got to the first king, discovered that, you know, so they got to the person who called them, realized, oh no, this kingdom is a bad place, and they got recruited into the Eastern Defensive Force, and then we did the first age skip. So they basically played kind of like quite young, they played most of their young life doing this, and then the second age was more about the Fox Knight suddenly springing his trap, and because there was an invasion going on, that the end of that invasion was the age skip again. And of course, that age skip was the big one, because we know the Queen takes over, we know the Knights, these people leave, especially because a lot of the people were then dead, so you got a next generation coming in. You know, because you're unrolling stat. You know, it's a weird, like, just murdering of, like, okay, which NPCs are still alive? Oh, no, this guy you met. Like, the players have never discovered, but, like, somebody they met once, like, early in the second age, his wife almost instantly died. And he's been raising his kids alone ever since. You know, and that's in the world. And if they ever go to the vineyard again, they'll discover this very, like, depressing sort of situation. So that kind of, you start from there, you see the people. Especially I find stuff like stat rolls prompting. Like, if someone's the husband of the eventual queen, when he became old, his clarity crashed and his health crashed. So he was clearly quite sickly. So the idea, so that was the prompt. The idea that, you know, there's that, she's nursing him quite a lot. They're very, you know, they were a great love match. She had to betray her father to go there. She's basically running this city on the southwest, which is the economy of the whole place, because it's big, it's a city by a lake, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This feels like, oh, this is where the food might come from. And but she's, as mentioned earlier on, she wanted to be a knight. She's the meteor knight. She gets to jump out of buildings like a meteor. And she hasn't. She has, due to her father's actions, she's been tied to this place and eventually tied to queendom. And now she's tied to a husband who is ailing, this great love of her life. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff. And it becomes both political, but it's also, I mean, it's both political and personal. And especially when you're in like a feudal system, that the actual nature of your ruler really matters. You know what I mean?
But did you roll on the unresolved situations? I think that is in the rules, right?
I did, but you don't roll for that for myths. That's the thing. The only thing I've... not quite true. Because basically, since they were not high enough ranking people, they didn't actually have problems they should be dealing with. They didn't have crises because they weren't quite high enough. But I did roll for like other smaller problems. And as they've got more powerful, I've certain rolled. For example, I've rolled for the king riding off to the east. How did that go, for example? As in, did it help stop the raiders or not? And yeah, actually, that mission went very badly, and the raiders have now come back. As they're now in their very old age, the threat that was originally dealing with is now back again. The wheel turns. Since we are playing it quite accelerated, yeah, you know, it's like 13 sessions or so we've done. We'll probably finish around 15. It does mean that some of that stuff isn't as much, but like, what we do get is like the myths hanging around. Like I said, like the mist arrived in the first age, we had an age jump. So it was like low level mist for like 15 years. And that for me makes it much more mythy. Like, you know, the Hydra also arrived. The Hydra's been vaguely bothering this place for like 30 years by the time they murder it. Or, you know, they finally defeat it.
I had the same situation with the mist, and my players refused to advance the time. They said, we cannot allow the realm plunge into famine. We have to do something. Also, we had the myth of the child, and that, as you said, the myth is hanging around because it's, you know, the omens don't advance, but, you know, the cult will not disappear. And my question was, will they become like this messianic religion in the south? Will it dwindle and become like some hermits, you know, spouting insane theories? And I made a role, and that made the whole world kind of more complex and more interesting. So even the myths that hang around and are not resolved and they don't progress, they're still there and influence the realm.
There's an interesting contrast there, because Ciarán, you're saying that you didn't roll to progress the myths. I don't mean progress through the omens, but there's some loose end associated with the myth and then that's an unresolved situation, arguably. So Horst, you're rolling on that, and Ciarán, you're not rolling. Is that correct?
The mundane element of the myth, not the myth.
Yeah, so in my campaign, we had the Citadel, which is this weird tower that appears, and the knights visited it. And there was a small settlement around it of these kind of soldiers that were loyal to the guy living in the Citadel. And then we advanced time, and I rolled to see what happens to that settlement. Does it become a new holding, or, you know, does it evolve into a new town or something? And it's still there. I find that quite an interesting way to go, you know, blending the myths in with the mundane more directly.
I've also had the myth, I also had the child. The child is still in play. And also the child has existed for like an age jump. So I've been playing with similar things, and I haven't rolled for either of them. I think what the mist was level one. If it was level two or higher, then it probably wouldn't age jump it. That does become a starvation thing. But like, that's level one. It was like, no, this is atmospheric enough to allow it to skip. That was the sort of feeling. And the idea of like, oh no, the
especially that's regular English weather.
Yeah, I live in that. But like, we could keep that around. So I didn't, but I used that to influence everything. Like, you know, like I could have rolled for famine and that kind of stuff, but it's more for the fact that, oh no, this kingdom has been in fog for 15 years. That's weird and upsetting, and also an amazing visual representation of the malaise of the king. You know what I mean? This is as Arthurian as it gets. I'll be bringing the child in because the child is a great end game, because these are literally very old knights, and now the child is still around. You know, the idea of this, you know, this thing is a great end to like a large campaign, narratively speaking.
Is the child still a child?
I'm playing as it is, because the next myth it is. But like, the Seeker knights are still wandering around the kingdom causing trouble. They were trying to kill the troll. You know, that's because, you know, there were knights attacking the troll. I made it Seeker knights. So like, it's still there, but I rarely roll for them. And it's like, I probably would more, I think. But it's more like stuff like the Hydra, the fact that everyone is scared of the Hydra made me, I didn't need to roll much. That's a background problem in the kingdom, I felt. So I didn't need to roll to see how bad it was. I just treated it, everyone knew it was bad, I guess.
I was thinking recently about the way the myths are written, because I'm seeing more and more homebrew myths that people are sharing in the Discord. And something that, I don't know if this is correct, so I'm happy to hear people's opinions on it. But I think Chris has written them in the way that you can't destabilize them too much, you know? You see little glimpses of things, and the knights can interact with that glimpse and they can disturb them in some way. But the next omen probably will still make sense. And I think it's quite difficult to write like that. It's difficult to write six linked prompts that, again, we're back to the word story. Whether it's a story or not, I don't know. But six things that if you mess with the first one in a certain way, all of the rest of them don't make any sense. You know, I don't think the ones in the book are written like that, but...
You've got a very gentle touch. You know what I mean? It's like, this is one of the things where you... This is one of the bits where prepping the myth too much is a problem. You know what I mean? Because you don't know the situation where it's going to be. So when it turns up, you need to be able to apply it. This is, for me, it's like you know the kingdom as well as you can, or as well as you need, rather. And then you know when this myth turns up, what's going to happen. And there's enough stuff flying around that you can work into that and build. I mean, like, I've only ever used like two of the kind of... I've literally forgotten the name of the dungeons. Like,
sites.
Yeah, sites. I've only like used like two or three sites in the whole game. And that's because they need a little bit more prep in time. And it's because I sort of see it coming. It's like, oh, they're going to go down the good. They're going to probably go down the goblin. Let's have that there. And then I rolled one for the entombed seer, because it was suddenly much more interesting to like have an entire structure with the seer in. In passing, that's actually another, I think, a good example of like what the prompts can give you. Because what does it say? An apprentice always mourning, a night guard always guarding. So I rolled both of them up. Where was the apprentice? And I rolled like runaway fugitive. And I suddenly like, oh, wait a sec, the apprentice is mourning herself. She's going to be because the apprentice is going to be the next seer. She doesn't want to be locked in a room forever, and she's only here because it's sanctuary. So her thing is, she wants to be get out of the kingdom. Can you, you know, talk the knights? Can you let me out? I can help, you know, guide me out of the kingdom, and I'll teach you the secret passageway inside so you can actually meet the knight. You don't have to, sorry, not the knight, the seer. And you won't have to fight this murderous knight. Except I've also rolled for the knight, and the knight's got clarity too. So, and I've made him old age, completely senile. So the second they meet him, they'll know he's not a murderous thing. The situation, she's going to try to lie to them and make sure to take the deal, and he isn't going to let them in either, but he might be able to be tricked in a different way. And I just let that situation go. That's purely prompt-based with a little map area, And then it just, like, what are you going to do? And there was like, I could see a few ways they could go through it, and I had no idea how it would play out. And players being players, they had the amazing kind of solution of the Hydra just kicked in, and the Candle Knight, of course, is petrified of the Hydra above all else. So they had her in tow at that point, completely petrified, and they kind of said, how about you become the new set, you be the new apprentice, basically. So you could be locked away in a room forever away from the Hydra. You know what I mean? And that, yet again, we talk about the bits of the myth being plugged together, you know?
So we have myths interacting with myths, and we have myths intersecting with the political side and the, you know, political reality of the realm.
In preparation for those sorts of situations, are the players interested in succession? Have you found them kind of seeking out young squires or starting families, anything like
that? I think these particular players have been slightly tentative over it. And I mean that kind of like, Jim's character did have a succession, and the other two haven't. Like, one of them has leaned expressly into the Moss Knight. The Moss Knight is very into like the kind of the pagan, almost becoming a green man type figure. He's increasingly isolated from the world. And the other one was very practical, but didn't want to have children. And she kind of views herself as a custodian, which is going to create problems, obviously, in the long run, because she won't get to choose her heir unless she does. You know what I mean? So, like, there's a little bit that. But both, all of them have been kind of, they've had an interest in the succession forced upon them. Because they've kind of, they've got to an age and they've realised, oh, wait, these kids are going to take over. You know? Again, the child's the myth is very appropriate. So, like, they're interested in it, but also kind of interested as people. When they met the Queen and saw the sadness of the Queen, that was a kind of, that was a real thing for them. And me, it's the sort of thing, like, you sit back abstractly, oh, no, the Fox Knight was right. He led these people into a trap and saved the kingdom. You know, but, like, if you see what it did to the Queen, you know, or the future Queen, that becomes much more, you know, stab that guy to death, you know, I guess. And that's, they're interested in succession because they're part of the kingdom rather than their succession. I think that's actually the way it's gone.
You mentioned a couple of times the wheel of life, the wheel of time. There's definitely the wheel of the year, which is already like the pagan concept of everything is going in circles rather than like the modern time concept of we have a bright future ahead of us. But then there's the wheel of life, if you will, where they go from birth, for youth, maturity, and then eventually they will die. How did that affect the feeling of the game? Like, when I'm playing Mythic Bastionland, already the wheel of the year gives me the right mindset to go all pagan.
It definitely feels, I mean, it feels really pagan, as you say. It's like the wheel of time, these are cycles, in time and space. And but first, it's like the fact we've had more age jumps than year jumps, that's the telling thing. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of, we haven't probably, we played through over a year once, I think, because that's the nature of how we're doing the age jumps. So we have not seen some of the stuff as much as other players would. So we're much more, less of the cycle of the year, more of the cycle of time. And it's, that's doubly so because of the wheel messing everything up as well. That the meal's around for like two or three of those regions. We lost whole seasons. I'm not sure if these players have ever seen summer. You know? Like,
well, I can tell you summer doesn't exist. There's only spring and harvest.
Oh yeah, harvest, yeah. Like, I was going to say, but like, we're British. Like, we're not used to, you know, having any heat. So...
And the pursuits, were there any, I think Brian asked you about succession, which is one of the pursuits.
One character, like, had a son and knighted them. One character, and there's just a series of big changes. Like, the big one was, there was, like, signal. They were mainly improving the kingdom in small ways. Like, there was a signal flare between the main capital and the eastern castle, for example. That was built by one of the players at one point. And there were like small settlements. There's like a hunting lodge. There's when one of them became the ruler of one of the holdings, I let her build a road between along the route of the army, the way the army marched between one and the other. So there's a road between those two. So that we've genuinely done that kind of quite big, heavier stuff. Oh yeah, one of them made like kind of inspired by the Queen's like bitterness and anger, made a unit of knights called the Brides, and that would take any woman who wishes to leave her husband and become a soldier. She has that as a military unit in the Northwest base. You know what I mean? Which is like So no, the difference between OSR and story game, it's like, no, these are all kind of the same thing. This is a cool thing. You know, it's a cool bit of fiction, but it's also very story-based, and it's also based around the interactions, and all that stuff comes together. And now we've got a military unit, you know, one of the best military units in the kingdom, mathematically, in the Northwest Kingdom. What's going to happen to them? I don't know. But like, it's like, I'm aware that the game could end with these last few sessions. It could become a civil war. It could become the person who's fed up with waiting, riding off to war. It could, you know, it could be everything is pointless. The invaders come back in again and crush the whole kingdom. Or it could be something much more peaceful. It could be a passing of a near age and ends up. There was a wonderful moment in the last session, two sessions back, when the young knight managed to reach out to the angry son of the queen. You know, he was going to kill the giant defending the Wheel of Time, and he talked him down in a way. And that was really, you know, that was. I really don't know how it's going to go. It's just kind of the point.
It is kind of the point. Like, one of the pleasures that I have when I run Mythic Bastionland, that I have not the foggiest idea what will happen, even if I read the next omen. Mm. I am as surprised, or maybe sometimes even more surprised than my players. That is a pleasure that comes from just allowing randomness to kind of determine the course of the game.
Just in terms of planning around time, because it does sound like, Kieran, you went into the campaign with a rough idea of how you would be managing time. If you were advising someone who's starting a game, if they wanted to get a full experience, would you advise kind of planning like three sessions, do a time skip?
Especially for coming from a more traditional RPG system. I think that the idea of selling your players on, oh, you're going to get weaker. You're going to be really stuck. That's going to be a hard sell for some players. And said that it's really going to be sold as a cool thing. So that's kind of like, we're going to tell a story of a kingdom. You're going to be knights. You're going to be probably the most important people of the age eventually. And then we're going to follow you. And you see the next generation comes in. You sell the cool stuff. How people respond to you is, I mean, it's one of these bits where like the knights arriving and being awed by them. These are the people who fought, rode out with my mother and defeated the Hydra. You know what I mean? Like, you get stuff from time which you don't get if you don't move time. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, you get to see wonderful things like the random squire they met in one of the first myths, who is now like 15 years younger than them, but now a very powerful knight in the kingdom. And they followed his entire story, and they've seen it across time in a way which you don't really get if you just play normally in that way. If I was running another game, the way I would pitch it is, we'll probably age jump whenever there's a major event. Like the end of a major myth, or the end of a war, or a big war. Mm. The end of the game, you're going to get old, and you can always play a new character if you want to play retire one, and the person moves off into some other position. And ideally, we'll go through generations. You know, ideally, you know, we'll play your children or people coming to the kingdom. And if I did a sequel, part of me would be tempted to use this map again and come back in 200 years. I mean, I don't know if I would do that, but that, you know what I mean? It definitely, you need all games. You need buy-in of the exciting thing of, this is like an epic. Like, it's not just like you going down a dungeon and killing some goblins and taking their stuff. This is like as big as you can get. And this is why I come back to Pendragon. And of course, that I can, as I said earlier on, if you conceive it as Pendragon, it is Pendragon. You know, it's like, what interested me about Pendragon is the idea of the generational play, the interaction with myth, this larger capsule R romantic scale of things. And if you sell that as the concept, you can just do it. So yeah, like, I would, I don't even like kind of, and at the end of a session, we'll do a season jump. Like, if there's not a reason not to, we move forward a season. That's kind of the way I would picture them. Because if you don't do a lot of season jumps, you miss all the cool season stuff as well.
So you have kind of legendary knights, legendary old knights. Do they have kind of nom de guerre? That is what I have in my campaign, where, you know, the one that slayed the hound is called the Hound Slayer. The one that challenged the elf to the duel is Elfbane. Oh, is that too cheesy?
No, I think it's amazing. I wish I'd done that. I mean, they've got titles. Like, they've picked up titles now, but like, they're more like Marshal Ogham. You know, that kind of like, you know, they've got the military titles. They're kind of known by it. And it's like, it's quite fun. NPCs just calling you by a title is good. You know, like, it's like, it makes you aware of time and history. And it's one of these bits like, if we had played another age and we're playing younger knights, they're riding down the road, and it's like, this is the road that Ellery the Great led an army in the, you know, in the mist and delivered the kingdom. It's a game about mythic scale, and the more you go through time, the more mythic it becomes.
You mentioned as a reluctance to advance through time, the idea of getting weaker. Mm. And I think the other one that causes people to be reluctant is the loose ends that they will leave. They want to complete the myth. They want to win the war, you know? And I think that's a tough sell as well.
If you feel something big has happened, then we'll do a job. You've read the myths, like, you know, these creatures hang around for a long period of time. That's the kind of, you sell at the beginning, like maybe the Hydra has bedeviled the kingdom for 100 years. Which, you sell that on the story level. This is the concept of the game. Problems maybe aren't going to be solved. But there's also, like, the second they understand the rules, whenever you ride somewhere, you're going to solve problems and generate more problems. You are creating the problems you're solving. You know? That's, you know, you're basically Batman creating supervillains. That's the kind of meta level. So it's like, no, you don't need to ride and solve the problem unless you really feel you have to. This is the buy-in right at the beginning, I guess. I've got an easy answer, because it's like players, if they don't want to do it, they really want to go and solve the problems. But kind of, if you've definitely got the core rules of, if a big myth that is suddenly bedeviling the kingdom is solved, it's probably a time jump.
The loss of control, like with the players, but I'm wondering with the characters. So you have all these characters in your realm that are making plans and they've got all these grand designs, and then random weird stuff keeps happening. How do they hold up in the midst of that? Like, do you feel it's authentic for your characters to say, here's my 10-year plan, when every few months something crazy happens that would derail a 10-year plan?
Yeah, I think that the entire truth, but it doesn't though. This is that, you know, the by definition, the story, these periods when we're playing is when stuff happens. This is going back to narrative theory. There's no, you know, scenes which nothing happens are cut. Therefore, there was 15 years of mostly peace and raiding, and then the period of myths happened again. And this is like, if you look retroactively, it becomes like self-fulfilling of why you're doing it. These are the periods we're covering because these are the periods when stuff happened. But nothing happened, you know, in the large historical scale, nothing happened in those 15 years.
Yeah.
And that's like very mythy as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, it's also historical. You know, like, you know, we tell stories when the, like, look at Beowulf. There's a good example. Like, Beowulf hunts, you know, does some stuff, then hunts Grendel's mum, then there's an age jump, and then he's an old man, and then he has to fight the dragon. There's no Beowulf in those 15 years. He obviously does stuff and rules the kingdom and drinks a lot of ale and mead and whatever. But we don't, you know, it's not like it was eight more Grendels coming in waves. No, it's a tower defense Grendel game. Oh, dear.
You were talking about that you, before the game, before you started, you already communicated the fact that the myths are not necessarily problems to be solved. They are things that you experience. And in the reality of your game, how did your players deal with that? Are they cool with that?
I think it's like, the more imminent the myth, the more they want to solve it. And I think that's fair, because I also wouldn't time jump if it wasn't. It's like, if the Hydra was like attacking the castle, I want an age jump then, because that, you know, in the middle of there. But if there's a Hydra out there somewhere, and we don't know where it is, that's easy to age jump, because it's like, oh, we don't know where the Hydra is. It's funny, like, the wheel is like the most destructive of the myths in many ways, but that was around for like three ages before they dealt with it, because there was other stuff that was always more important. Like, there was a war on, and the goblin was being awful. Or like the mist had to be dealt with, and, you know, and the Hydra especially, when eventually the Hydra became really important. So the question of priorities is there, because that's also true, like, especially now in the back end of the campaign, we're into the crisis stuff. The idea of, okay, what are the crisis we're going to deal with, and which ones can we ignore?
Domain level play. Is it mainly the crises? Chris sold it a bit as crisis management, but when I see the description of the court and the council, what I see is a lot of telenovela drama. Has that come up?
There's bits of it. It's one of those bits that we play short sessions. So, like, we're playing like 2.5 hours max. So, like, we play quite intensely. So there's a limit to what you can do. And the fact especially towards the back end, we're getting better at judging time. So we play quite modularly. Like, the last episode was trying to deal with the famine. And, you know, the episode before was hunting the wheel. So there's a limit to what you can do telenovela-wise. But, like, especially when they're in charge of a setting, you've got the characters, you can do the plot-based. You know, you do the interaction, as I said, with the Queen's son, you know, who comes in angry. You can do... Jim's character's wife is amazing. She's, like, the most practical woman in the kingdom. She's, like, about 60, and she's got vitality 15. It's like, she clearly should be in charge. And you can do those sort of scenes. And it's more like, you tend to follow what the players want, I guess. In the case of the troll episode, is they rolled a famine. Well, I'm lying. I chose them to have a crisis of the famine because there was, you know, summer was skipped. Sorry, harvest was skipped. So, okay, logically, there's a famine. Let's go from there. And they tried various things before ending on the, you know, the go and hunt the troll. And they failed. Like, the troll, they never decided to feed the troll. They've still got a famine. In fact, they messed up the fact, trying to get rid of the famine so badly with the first plan, they end up being a crisis of confidence in Jim's rule. So they had to deal with that as well, which bringing the troll did that. That's an example. And the next session we'll pick up tomorrow. They've still got a famine. That's probably the thing that's going to they're going to deal with or not.
Mm. Have you rolled woes for your dwellings?
Only when I need. This is what I mean. It's not often. If I need one, I would. Mm. Is that kind of like, it's one of those things like, because the players also want to hunt the myths. It's one of the things like you said earlier about the players want to deal with problems. If I roll a woe, it normally means I want them to deal with it. And in the case, like, if they start a session, it's like, oh, we want to go and hunt down the child or whatever, which they probably do soon. Doing a woe at them basically means more busy work for them. If I was running a longer campaign, I would probably do more, is the best way of answering that, I think.
Anytime you've mentioned them pursuing a myth, you've used the phrase hunt down. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, are they like quite aggressive
they can be.
In their approach to things?
Hunt down is like, they're quite incompetent is the best way. I just love it, like, literally, like, they spent like 2 days trying to, that's partially my fault, let's be fair, but trying to find a seer, finding a completely different seer than they were looking for, and then sleeping in the wild with two of them, one of them exhausted with vigor 0, the other one with vigor 2, and then they find the burning mother. I was pretty sure they were going to die there. you know what I mean? So, like, they quite want to know what's happening, because they're kind of like the classic adventure guys in many ways. Like, they want to, like, what's going on? We're trying to protect the kingdom. And, like, all the way through, that's their kind of thing. They're trying to basically make the things better. And mostly, the myths sound quite bad. And it's normally, by the time they're hunting down a myth, it's quite bad. This is one of the things. It's the difference between the mist, which they could ignore to begin with. Or, like, the underworld is one they've ignored for, like, 60 years. having, like, had one mysterious thing, like, but isn't that, as a side point, isn't that great? They could have the start of the underworld. Actually, two underworld prompts. And now, like, 30 years later, after the Shades killed a woman they met, that might come back in their old age. As the shadow of death comes on us, yada, yada, yada. You know what I mean? The age jumps make those sort of stuff meaty in terms of, like, if you met it, like, a week ago, that's one thing. It's like, I was a completely different man then. You know, my legs worked. Hunt is the wrong word. I think it's, like, quest. In that kind of, when it comes to a problem, they'll go and hunt it. And most of the time, there's a reason for them to be travelling. And of course, if they're travelling in a period where playing, myths happen. I mentioned earlier about derailing. Travelling alone derails. So you can set a problem, and then it becomes that.
So something I'm interested in, and it comes up in questions people have about the game, I think, a little bit. Do you ever skip travel because of that, you know, that it causes new things to occur?
At this point, no. Towards the end game, the fact I do time jumps, like, as we're ending a session, we get a month, I may start them in a different settlement. And then if I choose to travel, we're traveling, like, properly. Is that kind of like, I mean, I did pitch them early on when there was the big invasion by the army, when the whole battle was playing out. We can start the army halfway up the march already and go from there, if you like, or do you want to go all the way from the castle? And they said, we want to go the entire journey, because that's what the system, you know. And they were right to. It was an incredibly mythic journey, as they were, as I said, you know, the Wheel of Time turn, fog. That was such, genuinely, going for the mist with a whole army and being stalked by the things in the shadows, killed one of their squires for reasons. And they never, there's only 6 of them out there, because that's in the principles. But the entire army was sleepless, tired, and annoyed for the entire journey. They were down, they were obviously, you know, their spirit got incredibly low, all that kind of stuff, purely by the myths. And it's like, all the way, I was thinking, if they ride out and try to kill them, they'll just get rid of these. There's only 6 of them. But no, instead, like, an army of, like, 3 warbands, plus the knights, were harried by shadows for, like, you know, all this, and utterly made depressed. It was a complete horror movie stuff, you know what I mean? So, like, and that at the time, they were right not to skip the journey then. But, like, what is this session going to be? So, especially, like, any of the festivals, which were, you know, if you've got a festival, I might start them in that region, you know? Unless it was really interesting to travel there.
It's also an element of the how much time plays a role in how the wheel of the year returns over and over again, is these, that the year is punctuated by the feasts. Do you have like a cool story about a feast that played a role in your game?
Early on, there was less feasts. Just because now they're actually running a settlement, we're doing more smaller ones. We had what's the one in the middle of the year? this is the one where they were realizing about the Hydra being the embodiment of the sins, and they had a big ceremony. They had a big kind of like thing to try to basically ritually forgive it or whatever, or learn something. And we went through that entire ritual, and the Queen was involved. It was a great sort of Christmas one around it, in a similar, there was a, you know, not Christmas, but you know, a sort of yuletide winter ceremony. But also like the celebrated seer is right next door to their the holding they have now, and he's awful. Like, honestly, because any festival, he turns up and of course gets involved, because it's like, oh, there's a party, you say. Was I invited?
I mean, the seers are such great NPCs. I'm always sad that your players don't want to go there all the time, not to get any kind of information, but just for the weirdness of it.
They've got, but towards the end game, they've got more of them. Like, the early on, they didn't. But now they've net four seers in total now. And the two of them, the Scarlet Seer, she's the one with the heart beating. Yeah, the one who wants things to be interesting. They've met her a few times now, and I've met the Celebrated Seer a bunch, because he's awful. And I have fun, because they're so, you know, I play them broad. They're play, you know, that kind of, they're the level of otherworldliness, I try to go to them as in, oh no, these people are just wrong. And they haven't even met the third one, who's, is it the Blinded Seer? Is that the one? And he was like, this is an example of prep, like me thinking about opportunity. It's like, I knew if they went to him when there was the mist, there might be something involving him in the mist, because he doesn't want to be seen. You know, he doesn't want anyone to see. So it's like, there should be something there going on. And he would want the mist to be worse or stronger and yada, yada, yada. But they never went anywhere near him and still haven't. But he's awful. He's, you know, I know it's like, he will almost certainly ask them to blind another seer or somebody.
I have the entombed seer in my campaign as well, and they are mostly silent. I have a lot of scenes where the knights just stand in front of the tomb and nothing is happening, which is amazing.
There's a back door, and it's through, due to the, I said it was a sort of, I got the whole map of that area, and mine is that there's an entrance at the bottom of the thing, so you can go through a dungeon to get into the room with the seer. But that's actually, that place is full of undead, previous dead seers. So you've got to basically fight for all the other previous untombed seers to get to the seer you want to talk to. Then I've never been there. It's such really small, fun stuff, like the Boss Knight. You know, he had his stone he's been carrying around for 40 years, or actually, no, 60 years now, wow. Spends a lot of time speaking to his stone. And it's like, you say this stuff and it sounds quirky and silly, but like, it's also, and it is, but it's also like big and mythic and powerful.
I had once a Moss Knight in a one-shot, and I was amazed because I wasn't aware of the Moss Knight at all. And then I try to think about how would the stone like impart the information.
I vary voice a lot, and I do a lot about, okay, what would the stone be like here? Like, it is a wild stone. I mean, when they went to the entombed seer, he tried speaking to that, and it was like, no, he's a very tame stone, very formal, very proper. Especially, this isn't quite the stone, but it's like, stones are part of the woods, and I mean, like, there's various kind of. I've completely forgot how this ends up in the game. Oh, I know why. It was a random spark table about the scenery. But you end up like the oldest tree in the whole kingdom they end up speaking to. And that was in the goblins region. So it's, oh, right, okay. That presumably cares about the goblin. And that all ends up permeating through. And now occasionally trees speak to him if he's riding through. And there was, I made like one bit when they're riding out to fight the Hydra, having blossoms bursting along as they ride and that kind of stuff. Which are mostly, most of that's some sparks. Like, I think it's like, not extra blossom, but, you know, Chris would have written something better than that.
Just in terms of, I guess it's a bit improvisation. So at the table, they get into a situation like that. You roll on the spark table. You take a moment to think about it. What's the pace of the, how does that play out for you at the table? Are you kind of like pausing for a moment?
We play online, and I've got like two of the spark table generators in tabs. So I flip over the tab and press the button and get something instantly. So there's no dice rolling for my spark tables. Like, so that really speeds things up. And there's also a lot of, there's some stuff which is just me thinking about the situation. I said earlier, I want to honor the spark tables. If I kind of like, the situation is enough to spark an idea, I go from there. So when I'm talking about like the stones, what they like, that's me thinking about, okay, where are we? What's that feel like? And quite often it's the, if I don't know, I'll do a reaction roll. It's like, how useful are they going to be? Is this stone an arsehole? But one of my favorite NPCs in the whole game is, was the, another alchemist, a good one this time. It's like, Awful Alchemist was the name, I think. So he was like really scabrous. So I was, okay, he's here. He's got pet dogs for reasons too complicated to explain. He clearly hates everyone in this castle. And they've been here for 15 years. So I just did a reaction roll for one player. And they got a 6. Oh, he loves this guy. And then I rolled another 5. And then another like 6. I did the interaction of each one. Like, oh, Leo, oh, good to see you. Have this chicken, you know. And then the next, oh, you, and I love you too. And you know, the player's completely surprised. And it's like, I would never make an NPC where that who everyone else he hates everyone else but just loves the players. I you would never write that guy. But it worked, you know. It just came from this rant, literally the simplest reaction role, and was incredibly memorable. I think Chris has talked about this, isn't? If you get too hung up on your own ideas, the game can be stayed. And that's kind of what I like. I'm a, you know, my job is writing, so like I'm quite good at improvisation. I'm quite good at creating structural. I'm not good at everything. I'm certainly good at certain structural stuff. I'm good at thinking about how things cascade outwards. Like I mentioned earlier, the situation of the alchemist liking them all. Well, clearly everyone else hates them a little bit because the alchemist likes them. You know, why are they get, you know, like the second you start cascading out, but like that initial thing, something to move you to a different place than you would, is good. Like, you know, as I said, you know, honor the seers.
On the structural side, like you're kind of, I think, said that you might have two or three sessions left. Do you plan to do anything differently as you move towards the final session?
I think the last two sessions, it could have been the last one. We're kind of in a position now where it's like, we'll end it when it feels like a good final session. Like the one where they took down the Hydra could have been a really good final session. Like them riding out, dealing with the thing that's been, dealing with the sin that brought them here. You know, the Hydra is there because of the lie that brought them to the kingdom. These are the, you know, there's a really good healing thing. That could have been really good. And now it feels almost like after Lord of the Rings. In Lord of the Rings, after they broke the ring, this is like the Scourging of the Shire. You know, like when this, you know, we don't know how long it's going to go. So like it may be the last session next time. It may be two more. I think it may be three. But like, I feel they'll probably deal with they'll ride out, and they'll probably deal with the child somehow. The child is the nearest myth to their actual holding. So if they ride out, it's probably going to be the child that happens, and the child is a thematically powerful end and will probably lead to stuff. But also, I know the political situation. Like, I'll do a roll to see about how whether the invasion's happening or not. So if it's raiders coming from the east, that changes things. There might be, if the battle goes badly in the east, I'm pretty sure the king. The queen's son will just ride out and try to do something himself. You know what I mean? Because I've set that up. He'll probably try to get an army himself to deal with the problem. And then it's like, what happens then? I don't know. But you know, like, what he might do is watch their kingdom and demand an army to be given to him so he can go and deal with the problem. This is stuff I sort of quote unquote know might happen, because it's the sort of thing this character would do to a problem that may or may not happen. But will it happen? I don't know. So I don't know. It's really frustrating. It's like, I think it will happen next session or session after. I don't know what I'm going to do with the epilogue. That's the actual thing. Like, I think the players will find something meaningful. I mean, one of the players has said he wants to ride off to the east. Like, and he's the oldest sort of knight. And he may, you know, so he may not, or we may just age to death and see what happens.
So it seems like the city quest had never been part of your campaign. Was that a conscious decision?
I never thought they'd get anywhere near sufficient glory. In fact, they're getting closer now. They think they're on 10 glory.
But do they dream of the city, for example? Do you remind them once in a while that this is the Holy Grail they aspire to?
Only a little. No, it's not a major thing. They've kind of got, since they've got much bigger sort of initial problems to deal with, I've kind of leaned into the quest ignite aspect. And that's probably a side effect of the fact that I have prioritised the kingdom over the myths. As in, the kingdom is real, the myths are what distorts it. Like, if I was somebody who was more like forwarding the myths, I think maybe more I would, you know. And I think kind of, if I was continuing onwards, as they get old age, I think I'd probably bring if we're continuing, say, for six more sessions, I might be bringing in now. As in, you know, you're approaching death. Especially at your 10th glory, you're close enough to it starts becoming more relevant, I guess. And of course, you know, what was the city but an afterlife, etc. You know what I mean? Like, the Grail is the idea of life and all these stuff. So, no, but maybe. You know. Heading off to try to find the city. That is as good a guess as a final scene as any.
We have asked before another guest, Jesse, who is amazing and we love you, the question: how much of a story game is Mythic Pestilent, and how much OSR is it?
I think it's a really good union of the two. I'll take the centrist approach on this one. the story game elements that drew me to Electric Bastion Land are all present. You know, simple mechanics, kind of a fiction focused attitude towards the situations. But I do think that grounding that structure in an ongoing world that has stakes, concrete elements, that has a process for putting player decisions back in front of them as they move through a space is brilliant in the way that, you know, a lot of OSR and more traditional systems kind of, you know, prioritize. So for me, it's the best of both. I had not really run a lot of process heavy games other than Blades. I think that was probably the most mechanically crunchy one I've run in the past, from like a, you know, running a city, running all the factions, all that kind of stuff. This was the first time that I had stepped into those kinds of processes and tracking things like weather and time. And, it opened up my brain to whole new ways to enhance the story game element, to enhance the why of the situation and put that back in front of the players. And I have not found other games that do that union as well. So for me, I think it's both. It's very clearly, it's a toolkit that is polished from both camps, with all the best bits, which I appreciate.
And also, for players who are more familiar with one or the other, is it a good gateway for one into the other?
Like, it's interesting. I think Mythic Bastion Land, now I'm going to be, this is going to be really cutting now, I think. I used to be a games critic, as was mentioned earlier, and it was really hard to write about MMOs back in the early noughties, because this is like EverQuest era, and there were certain things that all MMOs did. And if you critique them, you were told that, oh, you just don't like MMOs. And then World of Warcraft came along and fixed all those problems, you know, people had with the genre, and suddenly it was the biggest game in the world. And then you could actually, once you had that example, you could point at what they were doing wrong. I feel a Mythic Bastion Land like that to most OSR games. It's rocks. It's one of those bits where, like, it's rock. It does really great OSR principles throughout it, but it's a rock solid set of systems for, like, systemic. It chooses the mechanics perfectly what our game is about. It's got the aging rules. It's got its kingdom rules. It's got enough to do big battles. It's got, you know, he's got these kind of stuff. But it also, you know, God bless people who are actually doing their actual own myths of Mythic Bastion Land. But you don't need to. OSR is normally based around the idea you'll be buying scenarios or making them. Mythic Bastion Land is a book, and it's a complete game. It's one of those bits where, like, when all OSR people say you have to, you know, scenario based, Mythic Bastion Land is kind of showing that you don't have to do that. We could just give you a game and play that. So, for me, it's like, this is doing some really interesting stuff to OSR that takes it in a kind of more, complete unfair, and I don't mean that, authored, maybe? Like, the idea of here's a complete experience you can explore. While still not betraying any OSR principles. You know, I mean, that's what I think is key. But I do think it's much more of an OSR game than a story game. I think it really kind of rewards story forward play. I think you can do lots of stuff with character and joy, but its heart, it's a simulation-y game. It just happens to simulate a world of myth. And obviously, I'm primarily a story person. That's not true. I'm doing my face here, like, I'm not sure. But
it's great radio.
Yeah, honestly, it's like fantastic. His face sort of crinkled like horrifically. I think it's really good for story gamers who want to play an OSR game, because there's much more stuff that may interest them. As in, you know, anybody who is like a story gamer, like, this is dynastical, this is adventure, this is a bit weird. It's got dungeons, but not in that way. You know, there's lots of stuff there. But at the same time, and it also rewards you as a story person who is interested in interacting with people. You know the classic OSR thing about, can we get a door open with a big pole? Something like that. No. Like, there was a game, there's a bit with the troll in the last session where they were trying to work out a way to capture the arm. And they were trying to work out, can they spear it? And, you know, it was notable because the game isn't normally like that. You know, the actual manipulation of the reality world is manipulating in a much different kind of way. And quite often about people. You know what I mean? And it makes so much about the action mechanic. Is really interesting in terms of how it's like, what is the leverage? What are, you know, and if you apply it to people, it's something that kind of like, okay, what's this person want? You know, all those sort of stuff wraps around. So it's kind of like, I think it's an OSR game which story gamers would find really rewarding. And I think for OSR players, it's kind of giving you an unusually thematically rich game, I think. And I say that with love, and I'm not someone who hates OSR. It's like, I stress.
I think that Mythic Bastion also solves kind of the problem of the hex crawl by removing the bits that are just annoying, the bookkeeping and the resource management. But you still get the basic idea of the hex crawl, the exploration, the traveling.
Yeah. And you also, like, especially with, if you grow across time as well, you get a sense of place. And it kind of like hex crawls are about exploration, but hex crawls are also about specifics. The idea, we are specifically here. We're in the past from this kingdom to the other. We've been here before as young people. Now we're back as 6-year-old men. And this is where when my arms worked properly, I fought a giant here, and now I'm can't pee properly. When you re-explore a space, it's still alive because the world's there, but it's also changing because the way Mythic Bastion lands encounter and travel system, because the myths there are going to be different. You know, everything stays the same, everything changes, which I think is a really useful bit of Hex. Because maps are interesting, because maps is a way of making solid reality, at least at a gaming table anyway.
Do you want the chance to talk about the oath as a form of prep?
I've sort of dropped in it briefly. My short version is you've got to invert the oaths to make it work. I'm going to argue about this, but it's like, protect the realm, honour the seers, seek the myths. Protect the realm, protect the reality of the realm. Full stop. That's the first thing you do as a Mythic Bastion land GM. You make the realm a real place. You have to protect that sanctity. It's a place where people interact and there's economics and travel and yada yada. Protect that. Make it people. Honor the seers. If you turn your seers are spark tables and the dice. You know, if you're rolling or looking up the spark table, treat it, integrate it. You know, if you didn't want to have an answer, you shouldn't have asked. So that's the thing. So make the game feral and out of your control. And three, seek the myths. You have to seek the myths because the myths are outside what you're normally are doing. So in other words, the myths are something you are found and added to the world you're protecting. So in other words, that the myths are, it's one of these kind of tricks of, you look at Mythic Bastion Land and you see all the myths because it's most of the book. But the core game is those 16 pages. I remember when I was a games journalist, I went to a games conference and somebody broke down what Super Mario was about. And like Super Mario, if you actually watch it played, about 80% of the time is you moving on a 2D plane. You know, it's not anything else you think of Mario, is it? It's you moving around on a 2D plane. And that's why moving on a 2D plane feels really good. They really worked at the basic moving around. In the same way, you know, the myths are what changes. The myths are the game, but they're not the core game. The myths are they are the things that distort. And that's why I think seeking the myths is important, because the myths are not in the core of the game. They're a thing that comes outside and changes things.
The next segment that we like to call You Be the Judge is about our guest, Kieran Gillen, talking about an interesting situation from his campaign and us trying to make a reasonable judgment.
In our game, the Hydra is the embodiment of the betrayal of the original king of the realm to the whole realm, and specifically the children, primarily the children. And they have decided that the Hydra needs to be, the father needs to be forgiven. To remove the Hydra, we can endure, but like if the children need to forgive the father to rid the land of the Hydra forever, how do you do that?
Let me just clarify. So the players now have gained that information from a seer. So is that a question for the players to how they decide to go about it, or is it a player as a referee?
What does forgiving the Hydra look like in your game? As in, like, what sort of thing do you think they have to do to actually perform that?
That would be something that the seers might suggest.
Yeah. I gave a specific kind of, you probably have to do this. As in, I think I said, you've got to do it face to face.
My first thought is that this is about people, and the monster is kind of secondary. And it's about bringing those people together and having that forgiveness be spoken between them. But for the spectacle, it would be nice to have the monster involved in some way. But I'm drawing a blank at the moment, like, on what that might look like.
Okay. if I were to run this and I had to come up with something at the table, my initial thought is it has to be some kind of like big ritual where a lot of people come out and something happens. And then when that's done, the hydra is gone. So the first thing that comes to mind is that the knights have to either find the hydra in like a sinkhole. It's like a, I don't know, kind of like a nice waterfall. And that's where it's hanging out because it can drink and eat fish, whatever. And then the father has to be there. And representatives of each of the regions have to be there as well with a horde of people. And they all bring some kind of offering of what is from that area. And they throw it into the sinkhole as a kind of show that this is what they're giving this up. So like the first thing that comes to mind is like bales and bales of grain that they throw in there and make it nice and mythic. So it gets to the point where like that what is being thrown in is piling up. And at some point the hydra comes out and the father speaks to the hydra. And then the stuff being thrown in continues to pile up and the hydra is covered. And then after the next rain, it all washes away and the hydra is gone as well. But the parts that makes it interesting is that the knights would have to then go to each of the holdings and speak to the people in power and say, listen, you have to make this sacrifice as a way to show that you are forgiven. And then the cosmic justice is that you will be forgiven in the future. And that's the cost will then be repaid in multiplicates in the future.
I have nothing, guys. I don't know.
Everyone's being poetic. My one is less poetic.
Can I add an addendum to my one? If it's just a scene between people, that once the father is forgiven, and if everyone kind of feels that this is genuine and it's not staged, he kind of collapses to the ground and he, apologies for anyone who doesn't find this pleasant, he vomits something up and it's like black bile, and in amongst it is a baby hydra. And this is like the sin bursting out of his body, and they can poke that with a stick or something.
I love this. This is all poetic and like deeply mythic Bastion like. What we did, and it's like kind of like I sort of knew, they were kind of wanted to do a ritual. They did a big poetic ritual, and that gave them the kind of final honor you need to do this face to face. They also kind of wanted to fight. So what they did, we used the gambit system to forgive it.
Oh wow!
So they rode up to the knights, and the people who were close to got advantages to forgiving. And if it's the obviously being the Hydra, nothing can hurt the Hydra. The only thing that can hurt the Hydra in this case is the forgiveness gambits. So the entire we just lean into the gambit system. So as they try to forgive the living fuck out of this Hydra, and it's big, and all the cast got to make speeches, you know, and like big emotional moments. But I like this one because it's a really weird example of like how the Mythic Bastionland combat system is really good. Anything can be a gambit. And in this situation, it's like, oh, being a gambit is trying to forgive it. It does H point damage equal to the strength of the gambit, basically. So that's the kind of, so if you forgave it really hard, you know, so we forgive the living hell out of that hydra. So yeah.
Was it trying to kill them during that
all
process?
All the way. So it's basically there. Oh, wow. In the sixth hydra myth, so the whole forest is on fire, the hydra is up in, you know, the fifth, not the sixth. So the hydra is breathing fire, it's up there in the forest, it's really dramatic, you know, and they're kind of desperately trying to keep each other alive whilst trying to use these gambits at the same time. And when they use the gambits, it's kind of, I let them take narrative control. This is kind of where the story gaming starts coming in perhaps a bit more. But when they narrate, I say, what does the giving the hydra look like? What can you see? But you know, it's all built upon that rock solid bedrock of the combat. We haven't even talked about that at all because we've been concentrating on different stuff. But the combat's really good in Mythic Bastion Land. It gives you a lot of flexibility and like to the point where literally we forgave Hydra to death, you know, and it didn't feel wrong. It felt like this felt suited because the attacks happened, blast happened, they nearly died. Like they, you know, multiple people nearly died. And one of the really fun things is the fact that we also established that if these two people had to forgive them, and if they were dead, it didn't matter. So in other words, if the two, the king, the queen, and the brother died, the Hydra would still go. You know? So it's them also riding off to a possible death. So all this stuff interacts. So yeah, that's how we did it.
Well, listeners, everything interacts. The myths with each other, the myths with the mundane, and everything is based on a very rock-solid system. I thank Kieran Gillen for being an amazing guest, and I thank all the listeners, and I hope to see you all next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.